stolen
engineering, worthy of a force that was a non-parallel on the planet. Even the president mentioned it. After all, having seemingly moved much of the U.S. to Iraq, leaving was no small thing. When the U.S. military began stripping the 505 bases it had built there at the cost of unknown multi-billions of taxpayers' dollars, it slaughtered off $580 million of no longer wanted equipment on the Iraqis. And yet it still managed to ship to Kuwait, other Persian Gulf garrisons, Afghanistan, and even small towns in the U.S., more than 2 million items ranging from Kevlar armor vests to porta potties. We're talking about the equivalent of 20,000 truckloads of material. Not surprisingly, given the society it comes from, the U.S. military fights a consumer-intensive war style of war. And so, in purely commercial terms, the leaving of Iraq was a withdrawal for the ages. Nor should we overlook the trophies the military took home with it, including a vast Pentagon database of thumbprints and retinal scans from approximately 10% of the Iraqi population. A similar program is still underway in Afghanistan. When it came to success, Washington had a good deal more than that going for it. After all, plans to maintain a Baghdad embassy so gigantic it puts the Saigon embassy of 1973 to shame. With a contingent of 16 to 18,000 people, including a force of perhaps 5,000 armed mercenaries provided by private security contractors like Triple Canopy, with its $1.5 billion State Department contract, the mission leaves any normal definition of embassy or diplomacy in the dusk. Anyway, the whole thing is just, showing you how the situation of the U.S. in terms of its war, its wars, was really a defeat. And he says here, finally, for Washington, if the guerrillas it opposes go to war with little more than the clothes on their backs, its military is another matter. For Washington, if the guerrillas it opposes go to war with little more than the clothes on their back,
uhuru, and welcome to Reparations in Action. This is the radio show of the African People's Solidarity Committee here on uhururadio.com. We'd like to thank the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru Radio and Uhuru News for giving us this time every week at 1 p.m. Eastern on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution, to represent the voice and views of the African People's Solidarity Committee, which is the organization founded in 1976 by the African People's Socialist Party for white people and other allies to work in principled solidarity under the leadership of the African-led Uhuru movement for reparations, liberation, and self-determination for African people. This week on Reparations in Action, we're pleased to present to you a presentation by the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, Penny Hess, who gave this presentation last week. Some may have been tuning in to the live broadcast on Uhuru Radio of the African People's Solidarity Committee National Conference, the 2012 National Conference in St. Petersburg, Florida. This presentation is entitled The Rise and Fall of the White Nation. It's about the birth of the European nation at the expense of genocide and slavery and the immiseration of African, Asian, indigenous, and other oppressed peoples around the world that built the wealth and social system of imperialism and capitalism as we understand it today as parasitic capitalism from the perspective and analysis of the African liberation movement as led by Chairman Amalia Shetela. So this presentation will comprise the entirety of today's broadcast, and will be the presentation entitled The Rise and Fall of the White Nation from January 8th, 2012, by Chairwoman Penny Hess of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Uhuru.
Entire continent of African nation, and that the African nation will be consolidated through the revolution and the struggle for liberation that wipes out the white nation. And so what I wanted to do was actually show. It's very interesting that we're in a period when the European Union is collapsing, and it may not survive even this week. Who knows, you know? And that, of course, that's not the end of imperialism or white power or anything like that, but it is an important step in this destruction. And it's, you know, and it's happening where, of course, the white nation began. And so what I wanted to do was show a little bit about what this attack on Africans and the formation of the white nation looked like, and how what we have to do now, what we have to do to take on our work. And just so we could understand a little bit about the history of that, and to say, excuse me, where's my little, I'm sorry. Do you know where that clicker is?
I think it's right on the
podium. Oh, yeah, it is. I'm sorry. Okay, thank you. Okay, so, and of course, this whole presentation is based on the theory of African internationalism. The chairman's theory, the theory of the African People's Socialist Party, which is a political theory that lets us see the world through the eyes of the African working class instead of through the eyes of imperialism, through white power, which everything is, that, you know, every novel, every TV show, every movie, every song, it perpetuates an alliance, you know, an understanding of imperialism, and that African internationalism turns the world right side up. And so the people who have made up the pedestal on which this system rests have a point of view, have an articulated strategy and theory that and political understanding that they're able to put out. And one of the things that the chairman has been saying is, as we were saying, the European nation was born as a bourgeois nation. That means that it was a nation of the ruling class, of the exploiters. It was a nation that everybody, no matter their income, no matter even, I guess you could say, their class in a certain kind of way, united with the interests of the ruling class of imperialism. The whole white nation has done that, pretty much. And it's been a bourgeois nation at the expense of whole peoples and their territories. And the chairman said, it is a nation that requires the oppression and exploitation of whole peoples for its successful existence. So, you know, just to think about that, the only way, our chief way of fundraising, you know, for this system of people being able to make a living, people being able to get a job, people being able to go to college, is genocide against the indigenous peoples, stealing their land, enslaving African people, stealing their labor, their civilizations, or constant, continual wars against people around the world to steal their resources. That's how the U.S. makes money. That's how they get rich. And that is what this nation has been about. It has no foundation besides that. So when we look at history, we look at the Middle Ages, we understand that scarcity led Europeans to plunder others. And, you know, and that was one reason. There also could be a particular quality of Europeans. I don't know, it could be, because there was scarcity in other places in the world as well, but Europeans from very early on, were plundering others to get what they needed. Greece and Rome colonized North Africa, so it goes back to there. There were colonies in those days. And the books, Ivan Ben Sertima, who was an African scholar, he died a couple of years ago, and he wrote a lot about, you know, Africans going to, sailing to the Americas, and they're known as the Olmec, and he was very much attacked by the academic community, the white academic community, for that, and very much appreciated in the African community for it. But he writes a lot about this history, and it's really, really powerful and important to understand it, because he makes a point that he said that the Greeks colonized North Africa and Egypt, but in a certain way, Egypt colonized them mentally, because and that is a certain way of looking at it, but really what happened was that the Greeks stole all their understandings, even these libraries that the Greeks understood, that this is Socrates. There were Africans in Greece, and Socrates was African. And they studied. They went to Egypt to study. That's where the libraries were. That's where the understandings were. That's where the understandings of math and science and astronomy. But what has happened, of course, with the whole concept of the white nation is all of that's wiped out, and the origin now is cited as Greece, as ancient Greece, without going to the African roots of that. So after the collapse of the Roman Empire, it was called the, quote, Dark Ages, which, you know, we could call it the White Ages, but a thousand years in Europe. And what that meant was there was incredible poverty, there was disease, there was almost 99% illiteracy in Europe, among Europeans. And it went from the fall of Rome to the rise of the trade in African people. So they didn't have any money, they didn't have anything till they began attacking Africans in about the 1400s. But, you know, if you go to school, if you go to in college or something in history, and they talk about the Dark Ages, but that was only in Europe. We have to get that really clear. The rest of the world had incredible civilizations in this period, the Mongol civilization, the Ming Dynasty of China, the Ottoman Empire. This is Mali, Timbuktu. This is the Incas in Peru. This was all going on while Europe was in the so-called Dark Ages. So, you know, the world was flourishing in this period. Science and architecture and, you know, mathematics and astronomy and the understandings of the people. I'm sorry, this is the Inca, not the Maya. But the Maya were there too. And it was an incredible flourishing of world civilization, except in Europe. So in 711, this is a part of history that's completely wiped out, and this is really important to the consolidation of the white nation. Most people don't know this, that, as Van Sertima says, most people don't know. People know that Europeans invaded Africa, but do people know that Africans invaded Europe? And they invaded Europe into Spain in the year 711 and were there for 800 years. And this wasn't just a minor thing, but the point that Van Sertima makes that's really important is that the Moors were African. This is a bust from the Moors from that period. But they did not destroy. They did not plunder. They did not destroy somebody's language, other people's language, or religion, or culture at all. That's what Europeans did and do. You see what what the U.S. did in Iraq when it, you know, had the shock and awe and destroyed all the culture and the museums and everything. But the Moors did not do that. In fact, what they did was uplift Europe. They were the only force uplifting Europe They spoke their own language. They did not require, and they had their own religion of Islam, but they did not require Europeans to change that. And this Spain was called Al-Andalus. Today it's called Andalusia. And that actually at the height of the Moorish Empire, it included Portugal and all of Spain. And it went until the year 1492. This is a beautiful palace. This was called the Alhambra Palace in Spain, built by the Africans. Just the architecture, you know, was so different. That in Europe, in this period of the Middle Ages, there were two universities in all of Europe. One was the University of Paris, and one was in Italy. 99% of Europeans were illiterate. But Africans in Spain opened 17 universities and had established universal education for children. Africans introduced into Europe at a time when people, white people couldn't even read, chemistry and math, art, philosophy, astronomy, timekeeping, in other words, clocks, calendar, paper making, law and civil responsibility, and even street lighting. They brought music to Spain. They introduced the game of chess. Africans had 20,000 bookstores in Spain, 20,000, so that everybody in Europe who was interested went to Spain to buy books, to have the learning. In fact, oh, and they introduced fashion that it never occurred to most Europeans that you could, you know, look nice when you dressed or that, you know, and just to go back to the bookstores and the learning, that the language of learning was the Arab language, was the Arab language, that the universities were taught in that. And so that the Africans were known as the intellectuals, as the scientists, and people came from all over Europe and the world to go there. They had hot and cold water and methods of cooling and heating houses, these incredible ways that they would get the air to flow. They had like air conditioning in the summer, and they had a way of heating. Very, really, really interesting. They introduced interior design. You know, I mean, it was just so clear because, you know, white people had these huts or whatever. I mean, nobody thought about this texture and fabric and how to make the house beautiful. I mean, they made everything in life beautiful. They created this street lighting, this system where these candles were connected to the houses, you know, laid out, and they lit them every night. And it was, you know, it was really, really beautiful. And of course, they introduced good food into Europe. And there's a question that, the whole question, because they say, well, the Moors had slaves. Well, this is a really important thing to understand, because Van Sertima says that Europeans, there were Europeans that when, and many of whom were even taken into North Africa, but as the chairman said, slave is not the right word. The condition of what happened to Africans in this country and in the Caribbean and throughout the Americas in, you know, in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries is nothing compared to what this was, because there was no control of life and death over a slave. That usually it was, sometimes it, you know, it was a person who lived with the family. They could get married, they could do what they wanted to do, but it wasn't anything like this thing that was actually an economic category, as the chairman calls it, that we'll talk about in a minute. So most of Europe during this time, and probably all of Europe, was under feudalism, where the lords and the ladies, the aristocracy, which was just a tiny percentage of people, controlled the lives of the majority of white people who were peasants, who were farmers, and who had to really give most of what they grew to the castle, to the lords and the ladies. And they had no power, no rights, they couldn't leave that land. And there was illiteracy, there was violence, and there was poverty and oppression. It was extremely, extremely hard life. And that Europe was isolated, it was poor, and it was disease-ridden. So when we think about all over the world, what was happening in Asia at that time, what was happening in South America, what was happening in Africa, all around it. And in the Arab world, this incredible blooming of civilization and understandings, but Europe was sunk in this desperate kind of situation. So the Crusades, the U.S. or the Europeans formed the Crusades, first started them in the year 1095. And if you read the statements of Pope Urban, who was the Catholic Pope who called for the Crusades, it was clearly go out to North Africa and get some resources. They have gold, they have honey, they have wine, they have wheat. We need it. You know, it was clear, it wasn't about saving the Catholic Church, except that the Catholic Church was the powerful institution of the aristocracy. It wasn't about, let's say, Christ or any kind of religious principles. And so the Crusades was, you know, we started to see the beginnings of capitalism. I think Marx called it mercantile capitalism. That was the beginnings of selling and trading, and you especially saw that in Venice and in the Italian cities that were right across from Africa, right across the Mediterranean. As the chairman talks about, the plague in 1347 to 51 killed an estimated 100 million Europeans, which was up to two-thirds to a half of the entire population, and it took 150 years to recover the economy. Well, if you go 150 years from 1347, that puts you right at 1500, which is the beginning of the trade in African people and the theft of the gold and resources of Africa, you know, coming to a very high point. So that's how they recovered. And Europe rescued itself by its assault on Africa and the world. And that is something that the chairman has talked about. He has told us. And it is so clear that that is true. If you investigate history, Europe was poor till it assaulted Africa. That is the only factor. That is the only factor. And I know, you know, just the times that we have been to the British Museum with the party and Luwazi, Secretary General of the ASI, giving a tour of the African exhibit and the Egyptian exhibit, is to see that powerful history. But if you sort of wander over to another side of the British Museum and you look at British history, it was in caves at the time that this was talking about. And you can see the whole, you know, because it shows each era of history. There was no wealth there until about the 1500s. So the time of the trade in African people, which began to bring in the resources from around the world into Europe. And the trade in African people began, it didn't totally begin at that point, but it began for Europeans as a sales of commodities in Portugal in the 1440s, Prince Henry the Navigator, which is really interesting because the reason that he could know something about navigation was from the Africans, the Moors that lived there. So, you know, this is how, because around other parts of Europe, they had no idea how to sail or that if you, you know, sailed east, you could eventually get, or if you sailed west, you could eventually get to Asia. The queen and king in the 1490s in Spain was Isabella and Ferdinand, and they were the first to be known as the Catholic queen and king. Isabella came, it was really her because she was kind of the leadership of the duo there. And, you know, she would send Ferdinand out to do the wars, but she's the one that kind of, you know, had the idea of consolidating Spain, because actually she was the queen of Castile, which is a white area of Spain, and she had the understanding to consolidate that into a white country, a white and Christian country. So, you know, we can see a little bit about what that meant. This is And I just think this is really interesting because this isn't the Ku Klux Klan. This is, they're called Hermandades, which were brotherhoods in Spain. And it's interesting because, and they still celebrate this, by the way, on the Holy Week before Easter. Every year in Spain, they wear this. And so, you know, people say, well, oh, the Ku Klux Klan saw those outfits and they decided to copy them. But that's not true, because the Hermandades were about attacking Africans and getting them out of Spain. And they wore these outfits to terrorize the Africans out of Spain, steal their land, and consolidate it into the white nation. And this is still celebrated every year in Spain. And, you know, it's very, very interesting how this assault on Africa began in Europe as well. So we know in 1492, Columbus came to Queen Isabella to finance him. He was Italian, to finance him to go to wherever he was going to go. And he didn't really know where he thought he was going to go, to India or China. And he came to her because she was one of the most powerful rulers of that period. But she wasn't rich. They were poor. In fact, when she came to power, their whole country was in debt, and their currency was worthless. It's sort of like the situation now. You know, they have this overwhelming debt, a worthless currency, and so, you know, she's figuring out, how can we get more money and, you know, consolidate this thing? And so she financed him. I mean, she recognized it was a good deal, because all of this was, you know, whatever he found was going to come back to Spain with a good amount for him to put in his pocket and his sons, which is what happened. And she had to hawk her jewels. She had no cash. So in order to, you know, build the ships and everything that were needed and pay the sailors and stuff, she financed that. She went into debt to do that. That was an investment. And people say, well, you know, Columbus thought he was going on a voyage of discovery. So many people say that. But I just want to make it really clear, because on his second voyage in 1493, Columbus had 17 ships and about 1,000 people with all the arms that they could. It was basically an army of invasion that they went in back into the Caribbean of that period. So they were very clear what they were doing, and they began the genocide against the Arawak, the indigenous people, immediately began wiping out. If anybody, you know, ever wants to read it, Columbus did have diaries, and he lays out what he did. And it's very, very chilling and powerful to see. They had dogs to just tear out the intestines of the indigenous people. They just would attack them, slaughter them, rape them, you know, anything possible. And Columbus is saying, wow, I'm going to be able to send back all kinds of resources just on, you know, Haiti and Santo Domingo and these islands in the Caribbean. He's, wow, this is going to be good. You know, I can definitely bring this back and that back. And in fact, he even brought some of the indigenous people back to try to see if they could enslave them in Europe. And it was very, very clear that this was about plunder and complete genocide from the very beginning. This is the origins of not only the U.S., but of capitalism itself, as the chairman tells us. And also in Spain at this time, so we have in 1492, we have Columbus being sent out to plunder and commit genocide against indigenous peoples in the Americas. We have this war against Africans going on. And we have this attack on Jews. And it's really important because it was part of the consolidation. African Jews who lived in Spain were actually, a lot of them were tax collectors. The aristocracy would name them as tax collectors. That was just sort of their job. They would do that. And for whatever reason, maybe the Catholic Church didn't allow that. It possibly didn't. But so Jews made a lot of money doing that and would often, you know, have their little side things going as well, you know. And so the aristocracy actually wanted to keep the Jews in that position. But the people, the white Spaniards, rose up against the Jews And so there was, or at least according to what I've read. So they instituted this hideous thing called the Inquisition. The Inquisition, which was torture, especially against the Jews. And they forced Jews to convert to Catholicism. And of course, a lot of people didn't. I mean, they just carried out their own thing. And then this horrible thing, which is the basis for what the U.S. is doing now, by the way, and for what it has done all along to oppress and colonize peoples, but just every form of torture, and they don't have them as much here, but they wore those capriots, those pointed hats of the Ku Klux Klan, while they were torturing people as well, in every possible kind of way, and then stole the land and the property of the Jews as part of the wealth that came in to the consolidation of the Crown of Spain. So they were stealing the land, torturing the people, and making it clear that if you weren't part of this white and Christian nation, forget it. You're going to be tortured, you're going to be killed, you're going to be wiped out, because this is what it's going to be. And Isabella started the first national police force in 1495 or something like that. She consolidated the police. She consolidated those Hermandades, those brotherhoods, into one national force that could carry out the will of the crown. And launched what was called the Reconquista, which was to drive Africans out of Spain, and launched a war that actually had been going on for a while, and the Africans had lost some of their land, but this was the armed force of the Spanish and Europeans to push Africans out and steal their land. So millions, or at least hundreds of thousands, of Africans were pushed into North Africa at that time, and all of their land, all of the beautiful palaces, everything that you see was stolen, and again came to the wealth of the Crown of Spain. There was also, just to say, the anti-Romani. The Romani are called the Gypsy or the Roma. They were outlawed as well, and they're the ones who often had the flamenco music, and you know, the whole culture. Of course, Spain adopted it all, stole it all, but tormented, and many of the Romani were tortured and wiped out as well. And Isabella established a national currency for the first time, her own, the coin. You can see the pictures of Isabella and Ferdinand on it. And got out of debt by stealing everything possible and consolidated the Spanish monarchy as white and Christian. And this was the time of the rising up, a huge boom in the assault on Africa and the trade, the selling of human beings. An entire continent of human beings turned into a commodity. The first, most important commodity of capitalism was African people. And that all over, you know, just sending millions of Europeans to Africa to be able to hunt for these African human beings to sell on the world trade. So as the chairman says, capitalism was born from the enslavement of African people. There wasn't a benign capitalism prior to that. There wasn't something that got bigger and bigger and bigger until it suddenly became a world power. There was no way, because imperialism and capitalism had so much wealth from the very beginning. So where did they get it? As the chairman said, Marx raises this question. What was the first accumulation of capital? Where did the startup money come from? And he says it came from turning Africa into a warren for the hunting of black skins. It came from enslaving the indigenous people in mines and stealing their land. It came from the opium wars against China, that he says, you know, that, and yet he didn't really understand it. It took the chairman to understand what this really meant. Marx had this as a footnote in that chapter 8 of Das Kapital, way back somewhere. But it didn't inform him that therefore the struggle that's going to bring down capitalism has to be led by the people in the pedestal to overturn this. It was not going to be led by white workers in Europe. That was, you know, that's clear to the chairman, because the chairman is the voice of the African working class. So if we go back to history, we can see the Treaty of Tordesillas of 1494, the Pope already in 1494 dividing up the world. He told Spain, you can have this, and Portugal, you can have this, and that's why Portuguese is spoken in Brazil. That's why Spanish is spoken in other countries in Latin America. And it's, you know, here's the Pope as the Christian monarch, the Christian leader. By the year 1500, 700 tons of gold had already been stolen from Africa and brought into Spain. Incredible wealth. 700 tons, that would be, I mean, I can't even fathom when it's $1,600 an ounce, you know. How much was that worth? That was worth trillions of dollars. The opium trade that Europeans went out, first the Dutch, then the British and everybody else. In fact, Holland had a colony called, it was Indonesia, and the capital was Jakarta. And Jakarta was a drug port. And the whole Dutch East India Company was sent something like 2 million Europeans to Indonesia for this drug trade that they had in the 1600s. This is what it's built on. This is what it is. There is no reforming it. And that Spain controlled the majority of the slave trade until the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588. And it was defeated by England. And at this point, England and Holland jump in, because this is what world wars were about then. Who could control the trade in African people? Because the Pope had said, no, just Portugal and Spain can do it. And everybody else is like, we want to do that. You know, we got to be part of that. And that's what pirates were. They were independent businessmen sent by often the Crown of England or, you know, the rulers, the monarchs of other countries, and then later just individuals who were like, well, you know, I can do this as free trade. The whole question of free trade, that's what it meant. We want the freedom to go to Africa also to steal African people and sell them. You had people like Jean Lafitte in New Orleans. He's put forward as this colorful pirate, but actually what he was a trader in African people who sold Africans at a discount on an island off the coast of New Orleans in the 19th century, and 18th century, that is. And it's, you know, this is what it was about. This was what capitalism was about. 1602, the first stock market, Amsterdam, for shares in the trade in African people. The Dutch West India Company actually was a company, a corporation of Holland that stole Manhattan from the indigenous people. And, you know, we can see, and I didn't know that it was 20,000. I knew that Africans are buried under Wall Street. You know that they found African graveyards under Wall Street, enslaved Africans. I didn't know there was 20,000. There's 20,000 people. So they have this little monument now, and that took a lot of struggle from the African community of New York to get that. The African Burial Ground, which is, I think, on Broadway in Lower Manhattan. There was the Berlin Conference of 1884 and 85, where European leaders came together to divide up Africa so that there wouldn't be another world war. That was the goal of it. Let's stop fighting among ourselves. Let's get together and divide this up. They divided up all the countries of Africa for the benefit of France, of England, of Germany, and Spain, and basically so that they could officially have it and have their grounds, you know, their little turf, to plunder and take out whatever that they wanted to. And then we saw the whole era of direct colonialism into Africa. We see the Congo, the genocide and mutilation that was carried out, which is beyond human comprehension, where at least 10 million Africans were slaughtered in the 19th century. And how many millions more had their hands chopped off? They say that there were piles, mountains of hands, that they would leave there to rot in front of the people so that the people would be terrorized by it. You had children, you had elderly because the Africans refused to harvest the rubber. But even if they didn't refuse to do it, this was done to them as a way of creating a model that you had to be afraid of. And yet, there was no outcry from the European community. There was nobody thought anything. There wasn't even the word genocide then. So when we go back to look at what is this primitive accumulation that the chairman points out, we're talking about stolen humanity and genocide. We're talking about stolen property and knowledge. We're talking about destruction of culture and beliefs. We're talking about torture, inquisition, and terror all over the world. We're talking about people being sent into the gold and silver and other kinds of mines to just work till they die. And sometimes that was 7 days. They worked to death for hundreds of years. We're talking about just white terror of white citizens who carried out terror that lynched, that terrorized and attacked Africans, indigenous people, Mexican people, and in the wars all over the world. We're talking about the rape of Asia. We're talking about the opium wars, attempting to addict the majority of the population in Asia to opium and heroin so that money could come into Europe. And we're talking about ongoing wars of plunder and occupation. These are some of the forms of the primitive accumulation. This is what capitalism is built on. This is what it is. It can't be made better. You can't put a Band-Aid over that. This millions and hundreds of millions of people have paid the price so that the white world could take for granted what it does, what it's going to do. You know, its lives, our lives. This is a profound thing, that African enslavement is the foundation of wealth inside the U.S. There isn't anything else. What else? What started? Where did the universities get their money from? Brown University, Harvard. These were slave owners. These were African owners of African people. Where did the law firm start? Where did the insurance company start? You can see there's Africans who have sued many, many corporations that exist today, banks, insurance, other kinds of things, train companies, that got their start from the enslavement of Africans that are still making billions of dollars today based on that foundation. There isn't anything else. Because even if you got some land, it was stolen land from the indigenous people. It was genocide carried out popularly by the white population. We have to look at that reality. And this is what transformed the peasants of Europe into white workers. There was no working class until the trade in African people. Suddenly, white people had to be pulled off the land farming in England. They had to be sent to Liverpool and Birmingham to build ships now so that they could send the ships out to Africa and in what they called the triangular trade around the world. And this is why millions of European workers came to the U.S. to climb up the ladder of success, quote unquote. They were poor. They were poor in Europe. They were starving in Europe. But they came here because they knew the streets were paved in gold. And literally they were. They were paved in the blood of the indigenous people and African people. This offered class mobility. This offered democratic rights to white people versus repression. And it was willing participation in colonial plunder and terror by white working people. White working people who should have recognized that our bosses were the ones ripping us off, but we attacked Africans in the most hideous way. Talk about a reign of terror. Talk about terrorism. Yeah. This is where it started. This is intrinsic of what U.S. capitalism and imperialism is. White people who, not rich people, working people. This happened at least 10,000 times. There's at least 10,000 recorded what are called lynchings. The Inquisition inside the U.S., the terror against Africans, and in so many ways that happened. And the genocide against the indigenous people. That's an actual photograph of After Wounded Knee of 1890, where the bodies of the indigenous people were left frozen in the snow until spring. And they came back and put them in, dumped them into mass graves at that time. The white people were, as the chairman said, armed in the people's state of the white nation, armed to kill indigenous, to kill Africans, to form this white democracy, land of opportunity for white people. And that the benefits from war and colonialism, patriotism, is white nationalism. U.S. patriotism is white nationalism. That gave us the social wealth so that even if we're poor, we can get a mortgage, we can get a student loan, we can usually have somebody in the family who can help us out, give a down payment on a house or something to help us out. This is social wealth passed down from the period of the slave master and the period of the enslaved. So that white America now has 5% of the world is 5% of the world's population and consumes half of the world's resources. And they talk about the problem is overpopulation. The problem is overpopulation of white people consuming all the resources of the planet.
Yeah.
Not sustainable. And that's why we say, because we understand what Chairman is saying, all white people sit on the foundation of slavery and genocide. That is really important. We all sit on the pedestal. No, we don't all get to share it equally. And that's what a lot of this occupation movement is about. White people were used to getting a bigger cut of the loot. And they're saying to Wall Street, give us back our, you know, we can't afford our student loans now. We're not going to get our pensions now. Give us back what we were getting. But we can't do that. That's like saying re-enslave the world even more so. So imperialism can continue to give out its little bit to white people. And, you know, parasitic capitalism affects us and all our relationships. We have to, you know, recognize that. Why, if we are the greatest civilization on the planet, we're the ones that really know the best. We're the wisest. We have to impose our will on everybody else. We have the highest culture. We are the most literate, et cetera, et cetera. Then why does the U.S. have the highest percentage of psychotropic drugs against depression and other kinds of medications in the entire world? Why do we have to use drugs, alcohol, and other kinds of things to deaden our brains? Because here is this reality all around us. And that this whole question of, you know, the world, of the U.S. going out into the world or here, you know, and shooting down Africans, shooting down the Iraqi people and oppressed people around the world, and that doesn't affect us? Of course it does. This is, you know, when people are going, you know, they're saying, oh, every day there's something new in the paper about somebody going to their family and shooting the whole family and then shooting themselves sometimes. But they're just doing what the U.S. does around the world. I mean, this is it coming back in, you know. And so this affects how we see the world, whether it's for the dollar, whether it's for profit, or whether it was as Africans and indigenous people saw it, as the world and the universe and all people in it and all beings in it, as one system interactive with each other. And we see this crisis of the white nation today. We see the loss of faith in governments and politicians. There's whole articles about that now. The U.S. can't rule the world in the same old way. People are rising up. We see resistance of oppressed peoples that created this economic crisis. Why do we say that? Why does the chairman say that? Created it. It's not because of a derivative or, you know, some kind of Wall Street. I mean, those were symptoms. They played into it. But the reason is because now the U.S. can't as easily go around the world and just steal with impunity the resources of other peoples. It has to pay a price to do that. And you see, you know, Obama, like, laying off some of the military. Well, they can't afford it. They're broke. And we see the U.S. world hegemony is over. This was in India, I think, a visit that Obama was making. It says, leader of warmongers, looters and exploiters of world's people, U.S. President Obama, go back.
That's great.
that we see the imminent collapse of the Eurozone, 520 years of white power. We see imperialist worldwide wars, and that the economy will never be the same. The American dream is over. And that deaths are beginning to exceed births in most white populations in US, and certainly in Europe and Eastern Europe. Children are expected and do have lower income than parents. There's downward mobility now. And social wealth is contracting for white people. We see white Christians in Europe becoming a minority. We see Africans in Europe rising up. We see white people converting to Islam. This woman is from England, and she's saying, I'm happy to pray five times a day and take classes at the mosque. I am no longer a slave to a broken society and its expectations. This is interesting. It's saying thousands of white people, in this country too, are converting to Islam. And I think it's Buchanan called it ethno-masochism, that white people, young white people, you know, imitate Africans. That's what's cool. That's what's cool. It's cool to be African. And that there's mass anxiety and a sense of doom everywhere. And the white population begins to feel the pain. The bankers and the ruling class, yeah, they're the 1%. They're lining their own pockets. They don't care about white people as much, and they don't need them. They're probably going to move to Singapore, you know, to China, to, you know, someplace else where it might be on the ascendancy. You know, we are taught that we are owed the highest standard of living. But the question is, are we the 99%? Of course not. Of course we are not. You know, we're in the top 20% of the, even if we're poor, of the entire world's population. And I just think that that's important because we hear this thing, we're the 99%. But we never wanted to be the 99% when the indigenous people were being killed. We participated. We didn't want to be the 99% as Africans are being shot down on the street and rounded up by the millions in this prison system in this country. We didn't want to be the 99% as the Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan are struggling. We didn't want to be in the 99% and the people of Palestine are struggling. You know, we only want the 99% when it comes to the money, you know, and certain democratic rights that they're taking away. Being part of the 99% has responsibilities. It has responsibilities to stand in solidarity with African people. And as the chairman says, Africans have always fought Wall Street. In fact, there was a huge rebellion coordinated by Africans, started out in Wall Street in 1741, that their plan was to burn down the entire city and take it over. And it was really, really well organized. You should read that history. But somehow, I think it was the Dutch at that time, found out about it, and they, you know, burned at the stake many Africans and tortured them and terrorized them. But, and there were some white people, too, in solidarity with that. But the thing is that Africans have always been struggling against Wall Street. So being part of humanity has its responsibilities, and that's what the Solidarity Committee is about. That we can't just say, okay, well, we're part of the 99% now, aren't you glad that we're here? No, we have to go back into the white community and carry out our responsibility to win other people, other white people. Wake up. Wake up to this reality. This government doesn't care about you. You served it well, but your time is over. So what are you going to do? Keep protecting it? Vote for Ron Paul? You think that's really going to save you? You know, that ending the Fed is going to help save America? It's not. America is over. And that this is the period where we have to recognize the start, the core, that this system is built at the expense of Africans, at the expense of horrible expense of everybody else. What you're tasting now is nothing compared to what we have done to everybody else around the world. And I say we, because we have been complicit in it, completely complicit in it. And that this is a period where there can be, in fact, there will be a new world. There will be a new economic society, a new economic order. It's inevitable. It will happen. But it will happen led by Africans, by indigenous people, by oppressed peoples everywhere, and we can stand in solidarity. Our interest is there. Our interest is there, not the red, white, and blue. Our interest is in the red, black, and green. That holds the future for all people, for everybody. That holds the future for the planet. So we say, you know, we stand for reparations, solidarity. It has to be organized. It's not enough just to think about it. It's not enough just to think it's an interesting idea. We have to take action. And it has to be against imperialism. We have to cast our fate with African people and with humanity. That's the only way. And that we have to recognize that we are the oppressor nation facing the oppressed nation. And that it's not a problem of racism. It's a problem of colonialism. It's two different realities. It's what somebody called, in a sense, the invisible wall that's right here in front of us. That instead of Africans being on the continent of Africa, they're right here. And that they are as restricted and repressed as if they were under Belgium, you know, in the Congo in the 1890s. That we recognize a counterinsurgency, there's a war against the African population right here, that it was COINTELPRO that killed Malcolm X and other leaders and attempted to wipe out and destroy the movement. But it did not, because the African People's Socialist Party survived. And the chairman was a veteran from the 60s to now, the only African that survived that. That is so critical to the whole world. We're sitting in this little room, and this affects the future of humanity. And we see this war being carried out against African people right here, illegal drugs imposed on the African community. I know my time is probably up. I haven't seen a note yet, but that we see massive imprisonment of African people for billions of dollars. I mean, what is the estimate that there is something like, you know, if you count all the people who really enter and leave prison in any kind of form in a year in this country, it's 13 million people. And at least half of those are Africans. And it's not about crime. It's about a system that makes money for imperialism. It's the growth industry. What is growth? Right now, in this economy, prisons are growing. There's more and more prisons, and they intend for it. They're saying that there's 7.25 million people in prison, on parole, or on probation. And the people leaving and entering that is, I couldn't see that, Jesse, is 5 minutes. Okay, is about 13 million people. The median household, white people have 20 times greater, even in this economic crisis, than African people. Median household income, $20,000 higher for white people than for African people. 35% of African households have negative net worth. They have nothing. Africans have had rebellions in London, African resistance here in the U.S., African resistance rising up. And the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is our mass organization working in the white communities to win other white people. And this is why the African People's Socialist Party exists. It has resolved the problems and the political and practical problems of the African Revolution. It is working for liberation and unification of Africa and African people everywhere. That Africa's resources, all of it, has to be owned by Africans, yes. By Africans. U.S. imperialism and corporations out. U.S. imperialism has to go. It must go. That the Uhuru movement is organizing African people and their allies right now all over the world, just quickly, and we'll see some of these pictures later, the work of the Uhuru movement in Philadelphia, Diop running for mayor, Washington, D.C., Uhuru movement in London, African Socialist International, the ASI in London, Mercola, ASI in France, ASI in Germany. It says 500 years of oppression is enough. ASI in the Bahamas, African Liberation Day, Uhuru House events, Nurse Mary tour, Nurse Mary Karoma from Sierra Leone, who has a huge organization for maternal and infant health, I should say, in Sierra Leone. She will be on tour this spring, and people can be part of that. The Marcus Garvey Youth Programs in Oakland, California, powerful Uhuru Vintage, one of the institutions that's growing, such a great picture. The Tyron Lewis Community Gym.